Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus and we stream live at kuci.org. Today's interview was recorded on Friday, April 23rd, 2021. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here today with Jonathan Small. He's an award-winning journalist, editor, and podcast host based in Los Angeles. His own personal podcast, Right About Now, features interviews with successful writers talking about their stories and backstories. Jonathan is also editor-in-chief of Green Entrepreneur, a cannabis industry website and print magazine published by the editors of Entrepreneur Magazine. He hosts their weekly podcast of the same name, and he's a regular contributor to the New York Times, TV Guide, Cosmo, Details, Maxim, and Good Housekeeping. Before moving to LA, Jonathan worked in New York as an executive editor of Glamour, Fitness, and Stuff magazines. He wrote the famed Jake column for Glamour and Ask Him Anything for Cosmo. You can learn more about Jonathan at his website, rightaboutnowmedia.com. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, great to talk to you again.
So good to talk to you.
So
the tables have turned.
The tables have turned. Well, you know, it is interesting because we met online somehow maybe almost 2 years ago, and I began listening to your podcast. And so I want to know, first of all, how your podcast came about.
Well, it came about really as a marketing exercise, literally an exercise that I did as a result of taking a digital marketing class in Los Angeles, where at the time I was trying to sell my ghostwriting business. I was doing a lot of ghostwriting for people, but I wanted to sort of figure out how to market myself. And so I took a class. I'm one of these guys that takes classes all the time. I like to learn stuff. And so I took this class. I was like the oldest person in the class by about 40 years. And I learned about digital marketing. One of our projects was, you know, figure out ways to market yourself. And one of the things that came up was, you know, have a podcast. That could be a good marketing tool. So I just started sort of as an exercise to grow my ghostwriting business, but the podcast took on a life of its own. It started, you know, the first few episodes are all about like how to get into ghostwriting and you know, how to do this and a lot of how-to stuff. And then I started having on, you know, real writers talking about their process and their lives, and started getting some famous writers to come on the show and some really experienced writers. And it became something else. It still, you know, hopefully markets me as a writer out there, but I don't do that as much these days anyway. And it got me into podcasting in a way that I did not expect. And suddenly everything that I realized I loved to do, which was interviewing people and doing producing and doing audio stuff, was all rolled into one platform. And I started loving podcasting. And I not only grew my own personal podcast, but I started a little side business of producing podcasts for other people, which is,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Which is it's a company, which I probably should have put in my bio to you. It is such a new company. It kind of started actually during the COVID days, but it's called Strike Fire Productions. And it really started off with a lot of my clients were at first in the cannabis business, because as you mentioned, I work for Green Entrepreneur, and which is, so I have a lot of connections with brands that are in that business, and they all want to do, a lot of them want to do podcasts. So I said, well, I know how to do podcasts. I can help you. So those were my first clients, but I also found some clients outside of the cannabis business. And one of my clients is SAG-AFTRA, which is the screenwriters, a Screen Actors Guild, and some other clients that are not in cannabis, like purely Elizabeth Granola, but you know, it's like the opposite of cannabis. But so it's actually what you eat after you have cannabis.
But, that's right.
So I guess short answer was, it started off as sort of a self-promotional tool, and then it became this totally different thing for me, which became a great passion of mine and ultimately a moneymaker for me as well.
That's interesting. So you started your podcast Right About Now in 2017. Is that,
yes,
that when it began? So then your guests, I imagine that you receive a ton of emails from publicists and the like. And so how do you choose who you have on?
I really just run it through my taste test. I mean, one of the nice things about working for yourself is you don't, there's no rules. there's no boss telling me, you know, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. And so I really just filter it through my own interests. Like, would I be interested in A, reading this person's book? Because I do read the books of the people that I have on my podcast for them. I mean, like 90% of the time. So that's time consuming, right? So I really want to know that that's a book that I'm going to want to read. And do they sound like they'd be an interesting interview? What could I interview them about? And then, of course, I ask myself, you know, would my audience be interested in this guest? I know I would be, but do I think that this would be of value to my audience? Which, you know, there's not a whole lot of transparency in podcasting about your audience. It's not like Google where you can, you know, when you have a website, you can sort of go on Google and see like the age groups of the people that are listening to your podcast and where, you know, I only know from, you know, my somewhat limited interaction with my audience, but I know that a lot of them are aspiring writers. And then some of them are just people who like to read. And some of them are, of course, professional writers like yourself. And so it's a mixed bag, but I do know, you know, given that I kind of understand somewhat who my audience is, when I'm picking guests, I think, well, first, would I be interested in talking to this person? And second, would my audience like to hear from this person?
So, you know, I've run into this with Writers on Writing, where I have on occasion booked somebody that seems interesting to me, and I like everything about them, and I book them, and then I read the book. Uh-oh. And or I start reading the book and I'm just not drawn in as much as I would like to be. And of course, there's all kinds of things to talk about. You know, I mean, with writers, you can talk about writing. And sometimes that's even more interesting, I think, to listeners. But have you run into that where you book somebody and you're excited and then you read the material?
Yes, all the time. And I'm a pretty tough critic, I think, because again, my time is limited. I have a bit of ADHD. I don't want to, you know, if it's a book is not really grabbing me right away, you know, I get a little bit frustrated. I think in those cases, what I do is, you know, I generally try to read the book or I'll skim through it if it just can't read at all. And then I try to find an angle that I'm interested in, that I think my audience would also be interested in, that might not have to be so much about that book because I didn't love the book, but more about like maybe something that they learned in the process of writing the book or, you know, something about their background that might be interesting. I try to find something in every interview that I would be interested in and that I think would offer some sort of value to the listener. Rather, you know, I try not, and when you're interviewing people, especially about fiction, it's not that interesting to just, especially if you haven't read the book, to listen to an interview about somebody talking about a book that you haven't read anyway. So I try to kind of go a little bit beneath just the story or whatever and try to kind of get into the process of like what created that story. And that seems to be more interesting, especially in cases when a book really just isn't that interesting or just isn't that well written. You know, it's interesting. I've even had people on the podcast that are very famous writers, but I just happen to get the dud book that they wrote. That happened.
Right.
You know, like and I want to talk about the other book that they wrote that I read like 3 years ago that I loved, but they're promoting the other book. And I'm like, let's just talk about this one because I really like this one. But I know how hard it is to write a book, and as you do too. And you know better than I, because you've actually written books, and I've just kind of written books that I never really, that I didn't even send out to publishers, or I've, you know, I can tell you long stories about how I've written books that were just completely printed online. And I've done, you know, I've done a fair share of writing in my life, and I know how hard it is. And so I try to temper all my reactions to knowing, like, listen, getting in this business is really hard. You actually wrote a book. So bravo for that alone, right? I think I get right now, I get pitched by a lot of people who listen to my podcast, who are like self-published and want me to put them on their show. And that is hard for me because not that I have any problem with people being self-published, but I just don't have the time to read like all these books, you know? So I've kind of filtered over the years where somebody has to have at least an audience, you know, that might be interested in, you know, if they promoted me, might be interested in, you know, my podcast, or they have to have a name in some way, or I love to talk to writers who are just starting, but I don't know if I have the bandwidth these days to give them that platform, unfortunately.
Well, I noticed from being on your show that you do a ton of research into your guests. I mean, oh my gosh, you know, watch what you put online because
did I call you out? Yeah. That tweet you wrote in 2017, I had to talk about it. No, I do. I don't know. Maybe that's the journalist in me, because as you mentioned, my background is I started my career as a journalist. And so I guess there's a part of me that was trained in doing research. And I did a ton of interviews when I was a journalist and still do. I still am a journalist. Really back in the old days, when I used to do a lot of celebrity interviews, I just remember I would be so nervous about getting in a room with a celebrity and not being prepared, because A, I would always have a very limited amount of time and there was a lot of pressure to get good quotes and stuff. So I really wanted to be super prepared. And I think I learned that lesson early on in my career. And going into an interview prepared, it just, you know, it arms you for that situation where, you know, maybe it's just not that interesting an interview, or, you know, the actual thing that people wanted you to interview them about is not really that interesting. So you want to go a little deeper. And I find the conversations are just a lot more fun that way anyway.
Yeah. Well, when I started my show in whenever that was 23 years ago, I remember having a poet on that I loved his work. And, you know, I knew all about asking open-ended questions when you interview, because you don't want a yes or no, right? So I had all of these questions, and somehow this guy found a way to answer yes or no. And I really never read him again.
I was so upset.
But, you know, I think that's part of it, right? Knowing how to ask questions.
Yeah, knowing how to ask questions and sort of pacing the questions, like not asking the hard question first, like kind of winning a little bit of the trust of the interview subject before you kind of drop the big question. You know, I always try to have a conversation. I try to get people thinking that, you know, this is not just a Q&A. You know, I think it's an interesting when you're interviewing people, a lot of people forget that a lot of interviewing is listening. And it's like kind of like when I used to take acting classes, and I had this realization when I was trying to be an actor that it's all about listening. It's all about responding to, and it's really the same, I think, with interviewing, where it's, you have your prepared questions and I have my research, but I don't really know where the interview is going to go. And if somebody says something to me, like I even remember in our interview that we did together, you said something about going to India, and I didn't know that in my research. So I kind of asked you about that. Like, I just like to go where the interview might take me, but I wouldn't go there unless I was really listening to what you said.
I wrote that down actually when I was thinking about, you know, what we were going to talk about. One of the things I did want to talk about was listening, because it's such a part of being a good interviewer, and you are a really good listener.
My wife doesn't think so, but I think this forces me to listen. This is like, this exercise of doing podcasts has been, it's like, it makes you listen, right? Because otherwise it's just like ridiculous. Yeah, it will sound ridiculous.
Yeah, but you are. I'm sure you are. Thank with you. Your wife too. I'm sure you are. But I also noticed, you know, what you said just, you know, a few minutes ago about following the interview, following who you're talking to, that you seem rather fluid. I mean, like, you know, we've all done interviews where there's one question after another and you really wish that the interviewer would deviate from the script.
Yeah. That's to me a little bit the amateur hour, when you get somebody who's just asking you questions off a piece of paper, and then you can tell they don't listen and they're just waiting to get to their next question. Those are hard interviews to do. I try not to do that. I mean, I have my questions. I always have questions written out before every interview. I'm sure I had them written out for you. I have them up on my screen, but I very rarely even look at those questions, unless the interview starts kind of like going bad or something. I'm like, oh, I better get back on track. But I find that once the interview gets going and you start having a conversation, everybody's interesting in some way. They always have something interesting to say. And it's really up to you as an interviewer to mine that. And so if they say something to me that, you know, wasn't in my script, like you saying, you know, I think you said at one point, you said you had a stalker. That was really interesting to me. There was something,
a peeper,
you said. Yeah. And I mean, that was like, I'm not going to let that slide. You know, I mean, I guess some interviewers might not hear you that you said that, you know, because they're so eager to get to the next question. But I think it's really about, I mean, when you're having a really good conversation with somebody, you know, at lunch or something. That's usually the way it flows. I mean, you're probably talking over each other more in those kinds of conversations than in a podcast interview, but still there's that, that kind of natural give and take. And then I think it's, you know, you're a storyteller, I'm a storyteller. I think there is sort of almost like a natural built-in narrative thing that I have in my brain of like, how is this going to flow as a kind of story? And it doesn't always work, but I have a sort of idea of a beginning, middle, and end of my interview.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't think it's occurred to me. Yeah.
I just thought of that. Maybe that's not true. No, I think it is true because I think I do think, you know, I often start my interviews. I don't always do this anymore, but somebody actually told me recently that they like that I always started the same. And I was like, well, maybe there is something to always starting at the same where I get an origin story. I usually do start my interviews with that. Like, what's your backstory? And then we kind of get into the present more. And that kind of gives it a structure, I think, where it's like, you know, people find out, give a little backstory on who this person is, how they became who they are. And then we kind of get into what they're doing now and what they've learned. And that's kind of the basic, but of course it can go off script pretty quickly. But that's the basic sort of structure that I kind of usually set up for my interviews.
Does that come from journalism? How you write an article?
I think so.
I think it sort of is.
Yeah. Like you want a lead, like what's my lead? I mean, it's important to me that I feel like what's going to be the first 10 minutes of the interview and are people going to be interested and what should I ask that would like kind of get the listener interested, but also the interviewee like excited about talking to me. Because they, you know, sometimes you're interviewing somebody who's been interviewed a lot of times. You know, like, I mean, I'm sure you've had, you know, you told me you've had John Irving on your show and you've had some really big time people and I have too. And, you know, I remember even like recently I had like, I think like during the pandemic, I had Betsy Johnson on my show, who's kind of such a character, and I had a million questions for her, but I know she's been interviewed a lot of times. And she's probably been asked about the same stories a lot of times. And so I had to kind of find, you know, what would be the kind of the special, like, what's my lead for this interview? I can't remember what it was, but I tried to kind of like set it up almost like I was writing a story about Betsy Johnson.
This is interesting. So now I want to go into backstory now that we've been talking for about 20 minutes or so, but
sure.
So you studied journalism in college?
Yeah, I was a liberal arts. I went to Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut, not to be mistaken with UConn. And it was a small liberal arts school and I did a lot of different things. So yes, I studied journalism, but I wasn't a journalism major. I was a history major. But I did study journalism. I had a wonderful journalism professor named Blanche Boyd, who's actually do you know her name? Yeah.
Yeah.
She's a pretty well-known writer and it was kind of fun. I had her on my podcast. Great episode to listen to because not only did I have her on my podcast and she didn't remember me. It was like 30 years later. Now she remembers me, but I found a paper that she had written comments on. So I read her comments back to me and she was kind of blown by it. It was really fun to connect with her, but she really got me into journalism. She was a special person, a very special teacher. And I love her writing. And so I took short stories with her, which is funny because I've never written a short story in my life professionally, but I did take that course with her in undergrad. And then, yeah, and I wrote a little bit, but I was more interested in sort of being an actor. I was a radio DJ. That's where all the podcasting voice comes from. And, you know, I was really into my radio show. I had this radio show called Finesse Radio where I used to play hip hop. Now this is like the late 80s and there weren't a lot of stations playing hip hop at the time. And I had this radio show called Finesse Radio and I play hip hop and that was a really great experience and super fun. But I didn't think I wanted to be a journalist when I got out of college. It was on my list of possible professions, but it was definitely not like top five. I was much more interested in maybe being an actor or maybe being a screenwriter or working for Sesame Street. I had all these ideas of what I wanted to do. At one point, I had studied to be a Muppet. I took a class with Jane Henson, who's Jim Henson's wife, and actually got a call back. It's one of my great sorrows in my life that I didn't follow up on it, because at the time I got a call back for that job, I had also just gotten offered a job to work as an editorial assistant at a magazine called Child Magazine. And I took the paid job and not the Muppet job. And I've often wondered, what if I took the Muppet job? What would my life have become? Who knows? It's fine. And we make the decisions we make.
Have you written an essay or a short story about that?
That's a great idea. I should.
I think that'd be
I'm great. Trying to mine. I'm really in memoir mode right now and trying to mine a lot of my experiences. And
yeah, well, there you go.
There's one.
There's a chapter.
I love it. To be a Muppet. It was so fun. She would have us go around. We would take two ping pong balls and there's a way to put two ping pong balls and to put a rubber band in between two ping pong balls. So they become like eyes. And then you put them around your middle finger and your fourth finger. And you can, it's hard to explain how you do it, but you make your hand move like a puppet and you have these two eyes and you just practice all day. Like, hello. And you're like, had me like doing these, like doing the alphabet. It was crazy. It was really fun. So I ended up not doing that. I ended up working for Child Magazine, which was a parenting magazine, which was weird to be working at when you're 22 years old and not a parent. And I had started off as a receptionist there, actually, just as a kind of temp job. And one day they were very short on staff, and somebody needed to interview George Carlin, and they knew I was really into pop culture and stuff like that. So they were like, are you interested in interviewing George Carlin? It was just a phone interview. And I was like, oh my God, yeah, yeah. And I interviewed him, and that was sort of the beginning, and it went well, I guess. And they gave me a job based on that interview that I did. And that was kind of where I fell into journalism sort of by mistake, because I didn't think I was going to be doing that. But that job ended up being a good job for a young journalist to have, because I got to do a lot of different things. I became the travel editor. I became their book reviews editor. And it was owned by the New York Times. So it was a good place to work in terms of like the perks and access to lots of things like the New York Times, you know, library and their journalists. And so that was a cool experience.
Wow. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm talking with Jonathan Small. And then you wrote an advice column.
Yeah. So cut to Child Magazine shared a floor with a magazine called YM, which no longer exists, but YM, which was stood for Young Miss at that time. And then they changed it to Young and Modern. And YM was a teen magazine. And, you know, at the time I wasn't that far from being a teen, and a lot of the editors there were, you know, we'd hang out at lunch and they'd hear me talking and they'd say, hey, are you interested in writing columns for us, or just even stories for us about guys, like what guys want type stories? And I was like, of course. And so it was kind of a freelance gig that I got with YM, writing these stories, like, you know, 10 things you don't know that he likes about you and that kinds of stuff. And it was really fun. And I sort of found this niche. There was just a need for that kind of story. And sort of my whole 20s was filled with me getting assignments from magazines about writing about sort of advice for kind of Sex in the City, but on from the male perspective type stories, until graduate a few different magazines later. I ended up at Glamour magazine in my late 20s, and then kind of inherited the there was a column there called Jake, and Jake is sort of this famous, I don't think it exists anymore, but it's this famous column that can't, you know, Glamour is an old magazine, really had been around since like the 40s. And it was just like, Jake was this guy who, you know, had opinions about women, and you could ask Jake questions, and he was Jake. And I assumed this persona of Jake and wrote these stories for them, like, you know, about like why I don't like Valentine's Day, and, you know, the importance of the third date. And I just remember these stories. I would come up with these like topics every month and write these stories. Now, I was completely unqualified to write this stuff. I mean, other than the fact that I was a guy and dating women at the time. So it was always kind of amazing to me. And now that my wife is a family therapist and a couples therapist, I think I'm even less qualified. I realize, you know, like she actually has training in this, but I often would consult with therapists, like when I got stuck on questions, because I didn't want to just give bad advice. And my advice was pretty benign. It was more about the attitude and the way I wrote it. And then when I left Glamour a few years later, when I came to Los Angeles, Cosmo approached me about writing their advice column, which was called Ask Him Anything. And there I had the identity as the guy guru, and I was still writing this advice columns. And, you know, I knew there was probably a shelf life to this because, I mean, at that time, now I was like, you know, in my early 30s, late 30s, and I was like not really dating, and I had a serious girlfriend, and then I had a wife. And so it wasn't kind of like I wasn't really up on the current dating thing as much. So those jobs stopped. I had to transition. I had to pivot and find another expertise. But it definitely paid the bills for a long time. There was like a market for, you know, guys that could dole out advice. And again, maybe part of my memoir is that world. And then at that time, I actually got this gig for Redbook called Diary of He. And it's such an antiquated thing now when I think back on it, but it was a online diary that this guy was writing, a character that I created called Zach, and it was fiction. And that was my first taste of fiction, where every week I would write a chapter for this online diary and people would read it on Redbook. And it was like my life living in New York as a single man. And I had to sort of create this character and all these characters around Zach. And that lasted for almost 4 years. So I wrote basically a book, but it was a book that never had an ending. It just never ended. It was just Zach. At one point, you know, I moved to LA, so then Zach moved to LA. And Zach was like a cad, you know, he was a bad boy. And it was sort of like an alter ego for me because I'm not really a bad boy particularly. I'm actually pretty, well, I don't know, maybe my wife would disagree, but I'm definitely not that guy that's like a jerk. Like I'm in a lot of like long-term relationships and didn't screw around that much. And so, but Zach was like totally opposite. He was totally unfaithful and had a drinking problem. And it was a lot of fun. And we actually tried to get Diary of He made into a book and a TV show, and it never really happened. But I always thought he was a fun character to play for many years.
Was there also, because I remember something, I don't know in what publication, but there was also something, one that started She. There was a,
yeah.
Was so that Red
Diary,
Book?
Exactly. So it was first Diary of She or something, or Diary of I think Diary of She or something, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. Diary of V. Her name was V, and it was part of Red Book. And yeah, and then they decided, oh, let's do a male version of it. And that's when I came in. So the Diary of V was doing really well for them. And so, and my thing did really well too. Like hundreds of thousands of readers, people like would, I would do these, you know, this is like kind of almost pre-internet, but I would do like these chats with people. I forgot how we did it. And people would talk to me as if I was a real person, you know, like as if Zach was this like real guy. And I'm like, wow, he's actually a horrible guy. So it was weird being, you know, answering questions on behalf of Zach, because he was not a nice guy.
There's another
essay. Some heart. He had some heart.
There's another essay. I mean, you have like a lot of stuff here.
I know. And we haven't even talked about the cult my parents were in. I mean, there's so much stuff. There's so much stuff. I don't know where to start. I mean, maybe that's the problem. Like, where do you even start?
You need an outline.
I do. I need an outline and I need an editor.
Well, what you do for other people, because you're a ghostwriter, mm-hmm. right? And you're an editor. So put on that hat. Those hats, right?
Yeah.
And sit yourself down and talk to yourself the way you would talk to a client coming to you saying, I have all of these stories. What do I do? How do I frame this? How do I structure it?
That's a good idea. I like that. Maybe it can be you. It is nice. I mean, it's true. It's very hard to, I mean, I think writing is such a solitary job. It's one of the things that always I don't like about it as much as how much time mm-hmm. that you're by yourself. And I was always fortunate because early in my career, I was always in an office with a lot of people around. So even though I was writing, I didn't feel like alone. But as I became a freelancer, I realized, wow, it's kind of a lonely profession. Like if I could spend all day here today and not have any interaction with anybody, and that would be my job. But I mean, I'm a pretty social guy. Maybe that's why I do podcasts too, is to talk to people. and to get out there.
Are you an extrovert?
No, that's the thing. I realized I am kind of like on the podcast and like he in this situation, but I've sort of realized that I actually, compared to my wife, who's really very much of an extrovert, I realized that I actually am a little bit like, have a little bit of social anxiety and kind of like to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. I'm a hybrid. I'm not one or the other, but I'm definitely not like the guy that's like the life of the party guy.
Hmm.
I mean, I can be. I like small groups.
Yeah.
I like, me too. Yeah. Yeah. My wife loves like big parties. We always have these big parties at my house. I'm like, no, scary.
Well, speaking of hybrids, let's talk about editing The Green Entrepreneur.
Yeah, that's good. Sativa indica. Yeah. Hybrid.
Yeah. So tell me about this.
So that was kind of such a strange confluence of events that happened, where I was just sort of like gotten actually laid off at the game show network. I had at one point in my career, I had transitioned because publishing had really gone away. And I had somehow not really in a way that was particularly like, wow, this guy really knew what was coming in the future. It was just sort of like lucky, but I had transitioned into digital video and I was doing, that was sort of the thing for a while and everybody wanted video. And somehow I was able to take some of my journalistic background and writing background and be able to learn how to do video and be a video producer. And, but anyway, the long story short, I was working for the game show network and they had hired me to create game shows for them that would live on YouTube. And, it was a really fun job and it lasted for about 2 years and then they realized they couldn't make any money off of it and they just laid off the whole department. But so I was in this no man's land, a little bit freaked out. I had two kids and no job and the industry that I had really been raised in was kind of gone. And I started calling some of my old people that I hired back in the day. And one of them being this guy, Dan Bova, who was the editor in chief of Entrepreneur. And I said, you know, I'd love to, I need a job. What do you know? And he's like, you know, you wouldn't be interested in this, but they are talking here about starting a weed magazine and website. And I was like, I'm interested in that. I mean, I don't really smoke, but that sounds interesting. And, you know, I don't really have another thing going on anyway. And he's like, well, let's just try it out. So I started doing this editing for this, you know, this Green Entrepreneur is basically entrepreneurs, as most people know, is a magazine that's for entrepreneurs. It's all about the business world. And it's been around for a long time. And it's still one of the few magazines that actually has a print magazine. And they're really set up like almost like a traditional publishing company that I used to work for back in the 90s. And it's, you know, it still exists today. It's just a much more scaled down version of it. And they started a website called Green Entrepreneur, which they made me editor in chief of eventually. And then they actually started putting out magazines. So it was like, I used to joke, like, this is the job I wanted 25 years ago. Like this was like my fantasy job, being an editor in chief of a magazine. Unfortunately, I mean, I love it. It's really fun, but it's very different now because, you know, the staffs are so small and everything has been scaled back so much. And so, it became, you know, it was me and like a team of freelancers basically putting out four magazines a year. But it was really fun. I mean, the first cover, we had Chelsea Handler on the cover and we did like a real photo shoot with her. And just like in the old days when I used to do photo shoots with celebrities and stuff. And she was starting a cannabis line and it really, I thought I was done with journalism. I kind of thought my life had moved to a different period. Cause I kind of thought journalism was done. But it turns out it still exists. It's in a very different form now. It doesn't really resemble that much of what I came from, but in some ways I like it more. I have a lot more freedom and I get to sort of be in charge, which is nice. And I get to report on an industry that is such a dynamic, ever-changing, bizarre industry. And I feel like I get to report on it sort of from the bottom up. Like I got into it, you know, I mean, there's people that have been in cannabis for years and I'm not one of those kind of old OG kind of guys, but I certainly have in the sort of legalization period of the monetization, the sort of the cap when capitalism hit cannabis and when cannabis became almost like what people thought of as the dot-com, you know, what was happening in the early 2000s, it's similar right now. What's happening in cannabis. It's very much, a lot of people are getting into it. There's a lot of money being thrown around. Nobody really knows what they're doing. The regulations are all over the place and it's not really, it's an industry that is in a kind of Wild West stage. And so it's fun to cover it. It's been interesting to learn about cannabis. I'm not a huge consumer of cannabis. I use it to sleep. But I have become somewhat of an expert in the business of cannabis just by default. And because, like you said, I like to research and I like to learn and I like to talk to people. And I have a podcast that I do for Green Entrepreneur called the Green Entrepreneur Podcast. And so I get to learn about the business from people. And then, as I said, I even have sort of an ancillary business that's connected to cannabis and that I help some cannabis people make podcasts. So I guess I try to find, you know, when I find myself in these situations that are new, I try to figure out what can I do in these situations that will be of most interest to me and also help me, you know, make a little bit of money. So I think I've taken Green Entrepreneur and tried to, you know, really kind of expand on what it originally was and what it is now. And who knows where it's going. Now everybody's sending me pitches about psychedelics. So I feel like, oh, my next challenge is I suddenly going to become the mushroom expert, which is crazy because this is like, if my friends were listening, they'd be laughing. Cause I'm like this, I was so scared of drugs when I was a kid. And like, you know, it was like the last person to want to do drugs. But you know, the business of it is a little different. We're not a lifestyle magazine. We're not talking about like how to make pop brownies. That's not really what I'm interested in. I'm interested in the trends and how people how people are building brands and, you know, like, what do you do? Like, everybody's selling the same thing. So how do you differentiate yourself from other brands? It's interesting to watch.
So I imagine as an editor, you get query letters from writers.
Is that I do. So? It's different.
Different. What do you mean?
Well, it's different now than it used to. I mean, of course, now they're not actually letters, but I mean, like I'm old enough to remember when they were actually letters with self-addressed stamped envelopes attached.
Right.
I do. I get pitches. I get a lot of pitches because we don't really, I mean, to be honest with you, and I should be upfront here. Green Entrepreneur doesn't really hire writers at this point. It's like, I do a lot. We have content partners that contribute they're printed in other places. When we do the magazine, I do hire a lot of writers and it becomes much more of like me getting pitches, but we can talk about pitches.
Yeah. Well, I, that was really my question, you know, because that's the gateway to a magazine if you're a freelancer. And so I'm curious as an editor, what puts you off? What impresses you? What makes you want to talk to a writer about doing something?
Yeah, I am. You know, that is the same. And that has always been the same. And it's the same mistake people make over and over year after year is that they just basically blindly pitch you a story idea that has nothing to do with the publication that you work with. They haven't, you know, this is a little bit different because sometimes the difference between publicists pitching me and freelancers, those are the two pitches that I get the most. And people generally don't really do their homework, I feel like. And sometimes like they'll see Green Entrepreneur and they'll just assume that it's green. Right. So it's like, oh, that must be like an environmental, you know, without actually having read the website, which within the first 3 seconds of reading it, you realize it's a cannabis website. I mean, it's like every single story is about cannabis. There's pictures of cannabis, you know, so it's pretty obvious. So there, I get a lot of like green technology, you know, and sustainability things, which is just not right for us unless it pertains to cannabis. So that's a little frustrating. So I do like when people kind of, you know, have taken, you know, if I'm going to take the time to consider your pitch, it would be nice if you took, you know, a few minutes to consider where you're pitching it. So, you know, in the case of Green Entrepreneur, I love it when people actually have read a few stories, get a little bit of a sense of like how they might contribute, and then maybe send a story idea. Or, you know, the other query I don't love is like, I'd love to write for you, you know, great. You know, where do I go with that? Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, take a little time, maybe do like a headline pitch, like send me like, here's a story I was thinking, like, you know, 13 ways cannabis can enhance your life or whatever it is. And then like write a little, you know, 3-sentence summary of what would that story would entail. Maybe even include an example. But those are the best kind of queries where it's like, I can see that story appearing on Green Entrepreneur or wherever I'm working. And don't kind of blindly send pitches out. I mean, I was telling somebody the other day, I remember when we used to get, when I worked at Maxim magazine, sometimes we would get pitches for poetry. I'm like, have you ever looked at Maxim magazine? This is like a magazine for dudes about, you know, I mean, it was the, you know, it just, it would like, we're not going to make an exception. Like, oh, you know what? We don't do poetry, but this poem is so good. We're going to just create an entire new column about poetry. So just be, you know, do your homework. It's not that hard to do the homework, to do a little, and try to be specific. I mean, if it gets to me and somebody actually has my name, it means that somebody did a little bit of research into, you know, where, you know, who to pitch. So try to find out, you know, who's the editor that works on that section of the website you're pitching, or that section of the magazine you're pitching. It, you know, give it a personal touch like that. It's always helpful.
Yeah.
But look, yeah. Editors need writers to pitch them ideas. I mean, it's always been that case. You know, you will rely on your freelancers to give you a steady stream of good story ideas. So Green Entrepreneur is not the best example of this because they don't do that as much. They don't hire as many freelancers as other places I've been. But you know, most magazines that do hire a lot of freelancers, I mean, they're just looking for content. And so you know, don't be shy.
I'm curious because in listening to you, you know, and you've been writing since you were a teenager, right? I mean, you went to college,
yeah, started
writing.
Yeah.
Have you always had a head for structure? It just sounds like you're the kind of writer that has an idea and knows how to structure it and knows how to sell it. Is that so? Or is that something you learned?
I think I learned that. I mean, I'm trying to remember back. We had a very good, I actually just did an interview with a woman who was in the same senior high school classes. She's an author now. And we both remember we had this incredibly good English teacher when we were seniors named Mr. Nathan. And we had this thing called composition where every Monday, everybody in the school had to sit in a room with these composition, those marble composition books, and write for an hour about on a given topic. And I think that might've taught me a little bit about structure, but it wasn't until I really got into magazines and I realized the way magazines are packaged that structure is everything. Like I often think of headlines first. Even when we were going to do our interview, I'm like, well, how am I going to frame my interview with Barbara? Because she's done so many different things. Like if I just say interview with, you know, experienced writer, Barbara DeMarco, you know, it's not going to be like, I need a headline. It needs a hook. Right. So we talked about rejection. Actually looking back on the interview, I probably should even talk to you more about that topic because that was sort of such a great topic, but so we talked about how to deal with rejection. So I framed, even though our interview covered a lot more than that, I did think about that headline even before I talked to you. So I think I'm a little bit geared towards what's the headline, what's the hook. And you realize that most stories have a hook, and if they don't have a hook, they're probably not very good stories. And the stories we're talking about in, you know, short form type stories that are 800 words, they have to have a hook. They have to have one hook. A lot of times inexperienced writers will not, you know, will try to do a lot in one story. And like, no, just take one of the best idea you had and just make the story about that one thing. And then, you know, then write another story about the other things you're talking about. But in my structure is like, what's the hook? And then, you know, it is an interesting to me that people don't realize that all magazine articles basically do have a structure. Like there's a formula. I think I didn't realize it until I taught it that there was a formula, because I think if you read enough magazine articles, you just by osmosis, you sort of understand the formula, right? I don't think I ever really thought, oh, there's a formula here, isn't there? But I mean, it's like, there's a headline in what we call a deck. And then there's the introduction. Then there's the nut graph, which is like the paragraph that comes after the introduction that kind of summarizes a little bit like the theme of what this article is going to be about and why this article is important to you right now. And then there's the supporting paragraphs and the argument. And then there's the conclusion. I mean, that's a very distilled version, but they all are basically that structure. And if you look at any New York Times article or any even New Yorker article, you're going to find that structure. It might be in a different, it might be the introduction, it might be 10 paragraphs, but it's still there. There's an intro, you know, there's a nut graph, and then there's the, so there is structure. I think without structure, writers are really lost. You know, I think that's the sort of weird contradiction about being a writer is that everybody wants to, you know, people think of writing as being very creative and I just want creative freedom. But actually, I think most writers really like restraints and they like goal guideposts and they like, I love when people tell me word counts and tell me what you want me to write about. Just give me the topic. I don't like having unlimited freedom. And I think most creative people are that way. I don't know. Or most journalists are that way. They just want an assignment. So anyway.
Right. But restraint, having some sort of, having some sort of restraint is really
guardrails. Right. Yeah. And that's what's so hard about writing for yourself when you're just basically, you know, like we're talking about me just sitting down and writing a book about my life. It's those guardrails. It's me figuring out what is it that I would really want to say. And there's so many stories to tell and where, you know, how do you even know where the guardrails are? I think what's so easy to me or about writing a magazine article or even writing a long form is that generally there's a topic or there's something and you know exactly what you're going to be writing about. You know, you're going to find things within that topic that you might not know right away before you start writing it, but you basically know you're writing about this one thing. I think that's very important for people to have that kind of structure. I think I didn't have a lot of structure as a kid. My parents weren't like really good at like structuring my day. So I think I sort of craved that a bit.
Well, my first assignment for you is to write that Muppet essay. That's killer.
Being a Muppeteer is pretty, I wish I remembered more about it. It's like,
well, just the idea that you wanted to do that. I think.
Yeah. That way I wanted to be a Muppet. I actually went, my father set me up on a lunch date with this woman who was kind of a young Muppeteer and, just like talking about her life. And she's telling me about how, you know, you have to be prepared to bomb. And I remember hearing like that. I was thinking, wow, to be a Muppet, like you bomb as a Muppet, you know, like how does a Muppet bomb? But she's like, you know, because I think a lot of people who were doing it were like stand-up comics and were like those kinds of performers. That's, I think, what's intimidated me about it a little bit, too, because I didn't think of myself in that way. But, you know, silly. I think back on those times and I'm like, you know, that was a silly thought to have because I wanted to do it. Jane Henson obviously thought I was good enough to call me back to like, you know, bring me into her workshop. So. Yeah.
I should have. So now you have to write about it.
Yeah. So now
just
that's
an essay. Don't think book because you're too busy for a book right now. You're too busy.
You're right. I think part of it is I'm too busy for a book. And that's part of the intimidating of
this thing. Short pieces. You can write an essay, a draft of an essay in a day.
Okay. You
know? All right.
I'll do it.
I want to read it.
Okay.
Before we go, because
I'm up a tier.
We have just a few minutes left. Speaking of rejection, it sounds like you've been really successful. I mean, regardless of the Muppet thing, you've been so successful in writing, editing. I mean, you're podcasting. So do you ever have to deal with rejection? I mean, what do you do with it when you ever have to deal with it, if you ever have to deal with it?
I will say that I'm not in a situation now where I'm pitching getting rejected for pitches because I'm just not in that situation in my life right now. So I don't have to deal with that. But I mean, when I was writing for Good Housekeeping not recently, but like the last 3 years, you know, the editor would come back with some pretty heavy notes, like that I would consider to be very critique, you know, very, they were good notes, but like, I still have to deal with like, you know, this paragraph was kind of weak and, you know, I feel like you need more detail here. So I don't know if that's rejection. That's more criticism. Rejection.
Criticism is even a good
criticism one, is rejection in some way. I made a joke, you know, I wrote a newsletter recently saying that rejection isn't, don't let anybody fool you. It's entirely personal. And I still like, there's a part of me that always thinks it's a bit personal, even though I'm about to tell you that it's really not personal, but generally speaking, rejection really actually isn't personal. And even if it is, who gives a crap? You know, you're going to get the work done. I mean, the thing that I always have to remember is that when I'm criticized, it always ends up being a little bit better. That's how I've learned through my career is through the criticism of people that were in good positions. You know, luckily I've had some really good teachers as editors that have taught me how to make things better. And I still continue to learn. And I hope to learn from, you know, the people I interview too. So I think part of it is like rejection is an opportunity to just get better at what you do. And that I loved how you said, you're not in the game unless you get rejected. Like,
right.
You know, you have to be rejected in order, you have to be criticized. And if you're just doing this and never going to receive criticism, then it's insane. I mean, there's no writer in the world that hasn't been criticized. And then when I went back and researched some writers that have faced criticism, I mean, there's incredible stories of like Stephen King, like not being able to sell his first book. And even like there was a hilarious story about Herman Melville when he was trying to sell Moby Dick. And one of the editors was like, I like the book, but does it have to be a whale? What about if it wasn't a whale? We want to fix, you know, like it's just everybody's gone through it. So, you know, in some ways that's your war stories that is going to make you a better writer. So it's just amazing how many people, you know, in me, even to bring this a little bit back to Muppeteering, you know, probably part of the reason that I took the job at Child instead of the Muppet job is that I was scared of failing as a Muppet, and I was scared of doing something for no money. And I was scared of like, you know, working, you know, I think I was fearful that I would be rejected in that job by society, by my parents, by, you know, by ultimately mm-hmm. by the Sesame Street people. Cause it was no sure thing. It wasn't like, oh, you've got a job on Sesame Street or whatever I want to do. You know, I would have had to really, so I think that fear just is has held back so many people. And, so if that fear of rejection is a great thing to overcome. I still fear it. I don't like being rejected, but I also know that it's always helped me grow.
Yeah. And starting with being able to take critiques is a good way of toughening up the skin, right? I mean, if you can deal with that.
By the way, my advice to writers who want to work, like don't push back too much. I don't know if that's like a generational thing, but like when I was first starting out, I never pushed back on editors with their critiques, unless they were just like completely wrong. But even if they were completely wrong, I was like, oh, whatever, this is what they want. They're paying. Right. I'm just amazed how much people push back and feel like they're being taken advantage of. Or, you know, I just read these comments at like Twitter or like in forums about like, oh, my editor wanted me to do this. And I'm like, yeah, because that's what people do. Like, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's like, if that's what the editor wants. So, you know, you'll be a writer that people want to work with if you're a writer that's pretty easy to work with. You don't have to be Hunter S. Thompson. Like you're just be easy to work with. And, you know, maybe before you react and get defensive, this is like what you said to me, think about it a little bit, take a pause. I'm learning how to pause more in my life, you know, take a breath and, you know, consider what this person is saying, you know, rather than you having a defensive reaction right away. Just like, and be like, okay, well, maybe that will be better if I do it that way. And even if it isn't, this is what they want. And so I'll give them what they want and move on to the next story.
Wow, we have so much more to talk about.
I know. This is fun. I love talking to you. Well, dude, this is part one of a recurring series.
Part one. Yes, let's do that because there's like a whole lot more here. And one thing before we go, though, you have to tell me about the cat on your website.
That's Seymour. I'm obsessed with Seymour. I have two cats. I shouldn't leave out Thatcher, but we have Seymour and Thatcher. And I'm like a weird cat guy. I really do love cats. They're like sort of my muses. And I've just always had cats all my life. And they're just, I think they're good for writers because they kind of like keep you company. And Seymour, you know, they're not too needy. So if you get into a groove, like Seymour's not going to like start jumping on the keyboard and stuff. He's just kind of around all day. He sleeps near me and he's just great. And sometimes if you listen to my podcast, Seymour will make an appearance every so often. You'll just hear a meow in the background and I'll be like, Seymour, shut up. Doing a podcast.
Yeah. I think I have heard him on one of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. I love that though. I think that's great. Barbara. Yeah. And I love that.
Do you like cats?
Oh yeah. We have two cats.
Oh good. Okay. So you get
it. Yeah. We have Rosie and Nigel. And, same thing, you know, it's great to have them.
They're companions. Know? Yeah, they're the
companions.
Best.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love them.
Any last words for the writers listening?
Oh, just keep doing it and read. You know, I think it is one thing that I've learned that you really can't be a writer without reading. And don't feel like you're cheating or not, you know, if you spend some part of your day reading a book or reading articles, that's the work. Part of it is reading. Read. Writers have to read, and I. It seems so obvious, but a lot of people don't read that want to write. So
no, a lot of people don't. Some of my students, well, not my current students now, but I have had students say, well, I don't have time. I'm writing too much. I'm like, no, you are writing too much. You need to read.
No, and you will not, the one common refrain of all the successful writers that and I'm sure it's the same with you, everybody I've ever had on my show that's really successful, the first thing they say is read. The biggest advice they can give to writers. And it's kind of like what I said, you know, how I learned by osmosis how to write a magazine article. I think you learn, and you also talk about rereading, which I don't do a lot, but you just learn, you don't even know you're learning it. It's like by reading, you're just absorbing all this technique and wisdom that you don't even necessarily know that you're absorbing. And it just kind of comes out in your writing eventually.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, we're going to do this again.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
It's wonderful talking to you too. I really enjoyed it.
All of you out there, yes, stay in the chair or at the stand-up desk or wherever you get your writing done. And we'll be back here next week. So come back. And in the meantime, have a great week. And anyway, stay safe.